A nation dragged toward a war most didn't want.
But when it came, America, in our own words.
If she is determined to have war, I would remind her that we have a navy in the Pacific Ocean, a mighty navy.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Stay tuned to WOR for further developments.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special broadcast.
Here's the bulletin. Washington, the president decided today after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor and Manila to call an extraordinary...
I'm a housewife in my 16th year. And living in New York City. I'm very sorry the United States has to get into this war.
I want to get my wits together. Now wait a minute. Wait a minute, wait a minute. I want to get my wits together.
The wrong that Japan did to us.
You weren't old enough to drive for another two old ones.
No, I wasn't 3A.
Oh, 3A. What do you think they're going to do about this bird?
Well, I don't know. My status will be changed. I know that.
Personally, I'm pacifist. But at times, circumstances overrule your personal opinions.
My loyalty to my country is unlimited and unbounded.
Mr. McGee!
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen. Welcome back to the Angry History Podcast. Much like things changed between September 10th, 2001 and September 11th, life turned on a dime between December 6th and December 7th, 1941.
Except that while America was taken pretty much by surprise on 9/11, Americans in the waning days of 1941 lived in a world where there was already a global war burning from coast to coast, and America was an island in the middle of it. That had been going on for 2 years, and while we were not officially in the war, we were already taking sides.
Yeah, any pretense of neutrality was pretty much tossed out the window in March of 41 with the Lend-Lease Act.
Yep, we began supplying the Brits, the Soviets, China, Brazil, and Free France, among others, with military aid, free of cost, which was our way around the Neutrality Act of 1939.
Right, and relations with the Japanese Empire had been on a steady decline before the sneak attack. In July of 1940, FDR ordered a trade ban with Japan.
That was in direct response to the Empire's invasion of Manchuria, China. And 5 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor, all Japanese assets in the U.S. were frozen. Yet diplomacy, albeit a liar's game of diplomacy, continued between Japanese and American officials right up to the attack. The actual minute of the attack, the Japanese ambassador was in there talking with us and to our face, which you can imagine really upset the U.S. later.
Absolutely. And then it happened, you know, and when FDR told his fellow Americans it was on, America fell in for the most part.
Yeah, the isolationist rhetoric. In fact, at that time, there was actually an American firster giving a speech, I believe, at Madison Square Garden at the time, talking about keeping us out of the war and ripping FDR. And he just kept right on speaking. He didn't believe that there had been this attack in Pearl Harbor. And so that isolationist rhetoric, that was about the last gasp of the American firsters. As of 12/6, they were on top of the world, and then 12/7 comes, and that all completely gets flushed and gives way to this attitude of vengeance for the United States and for the attack on Pearl Harbor and the men killed there.
Right, and it was really a determination to right a very, very serious wrong.
My name is Henry Smith, and I heard the president's speech today, and I think it was wonderful. And I'm on the maintenance staff of City College. And I hope to join up with our forces to help to right the wrong that Japan did to us.
When it comes to Pearl Harbor and the beginning of the United States' active involvement in the Second World War, which we weren't even calling the Second World War at that point, to give you an idea of how much our perspective is wedded to today and looking back with 2020 hindsight, we're so used to hearing FDR's speech to Congress or the various radio interruptions that we really lose touch what it was like to be a man on the street there or a woman on the street there on that day. So Owen has gone back and found these first-person interviews here, and there's really something to it. Just the average working stiff speaking plainly, maybe somebody who doesn't even know where Pearl Harbor is, much less where Manila is, where we've just been attacked, and they're speaking plainly unvarnished about the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, and so shortly after it happened, too. Here's another.
I'm an electrician living in the Bronx in New York City, and while I felt very keenly about this whole war situation, that we had no part of it at the present time with the attack being made on the United States, I'm in full accord with the action taken by the President and by the Congress of the United States. And I'll do all in my power to work toward that victory, which is absolutely essential.
I like you can hear a bit of the car horn there. This sort of brings me into the streets of New York in 1941, too, which is a huge deal for me.
Yeah, and I think really, I don't think it's an exaggeration. I was thinking while we're listening to them to really call this the angriest day in American history.
Huh.
I mean, you had a country that was coming on its own, felt it was at peace with the world, felt it had done its bit in the First World War to make the world safer, democracy. We were negotiating in good faith with the Japanese Empire, and then this knife in the back. And there was really none of what we saw on 9/11, where a lot of people were saying, you could connect the dots afterwards and say, well, we knew that terrorism was out there.
Right.
We knew that they had been striking us. Heck, they'd struck the same target before, the World Trade Center. But this was just, gosh, it just out of nowhere to a lot of people who just thought our oceans would protect us and we were going to be cool with all the belligerents. And then it just came home, this sneak attack. And it really was an angry day. And yet you can hear these people really putting everything together in a way that lacks profanity and has clarity that I don't think a lot of people today would really be able to pick out. And it's just live stuff.
It is. And it's that notion, too. I mean, it may be the angriest day, but there seems like in all of these, you'll hear there's such a measure of control in the voices of these people that, you know, it's almost kind of, you know, British in a way. I mean, they're very, no one loses their mind in any of these recordings. Yet the subtext is there. There was outrage and there was shock.
It's resolve. I mean, that's the word that you always hear, and that is another one, yes, associated with the British, but it's really what people had. They had a resolve, and they had just fought a world war, whereas maybe on 9/11 we said, well, how are we going to all pull together? What are we all going to do to what's going to be asked of us by our nation?
Right.
Where, you know, whereas we didn't, in World War II was pretty clear, okay, the world's already on fire. We just had this First World War, but, you know, back when we saw what our fathers did, you know, 20 years ago. And so now I guess it's time to go over there again and start fighting the Germans and fighting these players again. So I think it was much more focused. They were able to be much more focused.
Right. Isolationist no longer.
The fact that we have these recordings today upon which to reflect is thanks to the rapid response of the men and women working at the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk
Songs. Let your light from the lighthouse shine on me. Let it shine.
Prior to December 7th, the crews at the archive were usually out in the field. They were recording folklore and preserving American music like Lead Belly you hear here. As co-founder Alan Lomax said, quote, opening up new areas of America that hadn't been recorded before and finding all kinds of people, end quote.
And isn't it a great metaphor that they're literally out there recording and listening to music, and then all of a sudden this attack comes, and on December 8th Lomax telegrams all of his field crews in a fistful of American cities, and he tells them, quote, can you send us within 48 hours, it's a fast turnaround by the way in those days,
yeah really,
can you send us within 48 hours recordings of reactions of four or five average men and women to the Japanese aggression, get colorful people who speak well. Library will pay costs of discs, which will be used for historical record and possible radio broadcast. Signed, Alan Lomax.
And podcasts 72 years later, of course.
Yeah.
one of the great things about these recordings is that, you know, the speakers just go on and on, too. There's no media training, no like quick bites, no pro polish. Here's an unnamed, a lot of these people are anonymous, too. Where we have names, we use them. Here's an unnamed door-to-door salesman in New York City.
Had a different attitude been taken on the part of our president, we would never have to face or be confronted with a condition that exists today. For example, people may say, well, whatever was done years ago was all right. Two wrongs do not make a right. But England, in my estimation, has the territory that England has, what she calls by right of conquest, has been taken by force, might over right. She, in turn, feels that she does not want to lose any of those possessions. Therefore, she has called on this country, Germany, who has the right to expand, and there have been tyrants as great as Hitler. History shows that. And if Hitler would not have racial prejudice, he'd really be a great man because he'd be looking out for his country. But under the conditions, he cannot and must not win. Now we will take the condition of Japan. Japan, who wants to rule Asia and have a Monroe Doctrine, the same as this country, in her way of thinking, is correct. We have no right to condemn. But I believe that Japan has made one great mistake by sending a peace envoy to this country and then stabbing us, as Roosevelt would say, in the back. In other words, having a Bible in one hand and a dagger in the other. But people should not be disillusioned because they are under the impression that they are going to go to a picnic. But that is not so.
I like picnics.
Who would possibly think it was a picnic? You don't bring sushi to a picnic.
No. That's true. You don't, do you? everyone's going to get food poisoning, especially if it's a hot day like today. What are you guys, 100 degrees?
Yeah, it's pretty hot. Yeah, I think it was 91 when I went out to lunch at Radio City. It was like I went to my food trucks, dude. And it was like, whoa, the food trucks were they were cooking my tacos there right in the
Right. And you were just having carrots. It was awful.
Yeah.
This guy's interesting. First of all, I wonder what he was selling, and I wonder how well he did, because he just doesn't stop.
Yeah, no,
really, you would
pitch.
Like to have this vacuum cleaner, and if you don't buy this vacuum cleaner, it's going to be like having a Bible in one hand and a knife in the other.
You know, Hitler would have really liked to vacuum. But do you see how good this vacuum is? It's much better than Mussolini's selling. That's crap.
That's right. This vacuum cleaner kills fascists.
Yeah. Oh, but, we hope you get that one. I hope there's some people out there laughing because that was an awesome joke.
Now, the thing is, he makes this point, though, about, and this is your area more than mine. He says, England, in my estimation, the territory that England has and what she calls by right of conquest has been taken by force. Might over right. She, in turn, feels that she does not want to lose any of those possessions. Therefore, she has called on this country. Now, it's not quite as cut and dry as that, is it?
No, and in fact, there is a really great line from one of Churchill's speeches when he talks about this very attitude.
Would the invaders consent to visit Lord Beaverbrook's exhibition? Or listen to the impassioned appeals of Mr. Lloyd George and have their inferiority complex removed in friendly, reasonable debate? I doubt it. I have borne responsibility for the safety of this country in grievous times. I gravely doubt it. But even if they did, I am not so sure we should convince them and persuade them to go back quietly home. They might say, it seems to me, you are rich, we are poor, you seem well fed, we are hungry, you have been victorious, we have been defeated, you have valuable colonies, we have none, you have your navy, where is ours? You have had the past, let us have the future. Above all, I fear, they would say, you are weak, and we are strong.
And that's a direct response to this attitude. And you could probably, again, looking back in time, looking at what that guy was thinking, a different version of the fact that we just fought a war against these people and thinking, oh, but here we go again. Hey, it's just another country. People were fighting wars all the time back then in a way we probably can't conceive. I mean, this was really the third go in some people's lifetimes between Germany and its neighbors. When you think about it, you had 1871 of them marching into France. You had, 1914 and then marching into France. And then you had, 1940 where, wait for it, they marched into France again. So it was probably, it was kind of tiresome. There was still some lingering anti-British sentiment. As little as 40 years before, we'd been facing off at the possibility of possibly fighting a war with England. In fact, right. Churchill himself was thinking he was going to have to come back on an invasion force when he had left Canada on his book tour and be part of an invasion force of the United States. So it wasn't as cut as we think of it today. Good guy, a bad guy. People didn't necessarily see it that way. And there were a lot of German Americans, just as there were a lot of Japanese Americans.
It's a great point.
The swift Japanese advance on the national capital make the vicinity of Nanking a place of danger. The Nipponese invaders strike westward with incredible speed.
Up till this point, the people who most acutely felt the tip of the Japanese spear, this giant, hungry, murderous, bloody-handed war machine, were the people of China. And I was actually talking to a friend of mine tonight. He was Chinese-American, and asking him about his family and how they would have felt in China when this happened, because we tend to focus on Britain because we have Churchill saying he went to bed that night and slept the first good night's sleep he'd had in a while because he knew the Americans were coming. Yeah. And so, they had felt it and they'd seen their homeland being overrun. We see the same thing happening today in a lot of places. And you can imagine when people hear the Americans are coming and they're being shot and tortured and poisoned and raped in Nanking and murdered.
Right.
They're happy to hear about it.
And the thing is, too, I mean, so the aggression, first of all, Japan and China had been at it. I mean, they first started fighting like in the 600s. And it's just been, back and forth throughout the centuries. But what was this great Japanese thirst for? Was it because they were such a small landmass that was so resource poor that they were just like, all right, we need you. We need this land. We're going to take it.
Yeah, I think it was the same. There's a reason they had so much in common with the Nazis, to the point Hitler assigned some of his little kooky mad scientists there to find a way to prove that the Japanese were Aryan. I don't know what he thought. Some Fraulein walked all the way from Germany, clear across Russia, yes. And then found Japan.
Yeah, so here we are again. How surprisingly efficient.
No, but they just felt they were destined to have an empire. That what that guy was just saying, and what Churchill said some people's attitude was, that really was the Japanese attitude. We're better. They'd beaten Russia, don't forget, at the turn of the century.
Right.
That was the war that Theodore Roosevelt won the Nobel Prize for setting terms for. Mm-hmm. And that was really a shock also to people in Europe, because here was a Asian country beating a European power, a real country with buildings and, not made out of paper and whatnot. And so that made people stand up and take notice of the Japanese. And it made the Japanese stand up and take notice of themselves and say, hey, what the heck are all these foreign powers doing in Asia? And a lot of people in the Asian countries felt the same way. Well, hey, we'd rather be partnered up with the Japanese. But they didn't know what the Japanese were going to become when they started coming in. And really, again, like our friends, the Nazis, going to a place like Ukraine, and they're kind of happy the Soviets aren't there anymore.
Right.
But then the mass graves start and the shootings, and they turn in all your Jewish people, and they say, oh my gosh, you know the devil that you have.
Right. With whom do we lie down? So anyway, back to this notion of China and Japan. Here, December 8th, in New York City, is a soundbite from a Chinese student living in Gotham at the time. Give a listen.
I was born in China. I'm student in London at the same time. And the Congress declared on Japan, I'm very happy about. Because Japan's always pick on a small nation and a weak one. And now they're picking on the U.S. And I don't think it take long to clean that war bird out of Tokyo. Well, I received a letter from China lately. And they describe about the condition over there, but our people live, they are unoccupied territory. So it didn't affect our family much. I was happy about that too.
And really, you talk about, Chinese sacrifice too. Doolittle Raid, which was, what, Dean, April of 42?
Yeah, 250,000 dead in retaliation for... Yeah. for them sheltering our pilots in the Doolittle Raid.
I mean, 250,000 people.
Yeah, I mean, think about the biggest stadium, something we did on our Facebook page. Illustrating the deaths at the Somme in the terms of football stadiums. Think how many football stadiums you could fill with 250,000 people. Think how many big cities you know that are that size.
Right.
And we can't get our mind around it. And it's also one of the major arguments that Truman made and that people make today when they talk
about the atomic bombings.
Yes, that, you know, there wasn't nobody dying. It wasn't this stalemate. They were still killing a lot of Chinese people at a clip every single day. In fact, people still die to this day from the wells that the Imperial Japan poisoned in China.
This is just, it's nuts. It's really insane to think about, you know, and now, gosh, can you imagine what, you know, we must have been thinking, like, wow, now we're going to go and fight these guys. Because the reputation was there, you know, obviously before Doolittle, you know, Nanking mentioned before. I mean, this was not going to be a picnic, as our salesman said. But
yeah, that's true. I mean, he was prescient in that, because I think also, despite the fact they had beaten the Russians, we talked about that and about the attitude of, wow, they took on some European armies that are more modern. You know, we still didn't have a real face-to-face. You're going to meet this enemy that we hadn't fought directly before. They weren't fighting us in the First World War. So
That
had to be a little bit of a mystery.
Right. But I mean, there's also no way that Japan really could have thought they were going to beat us. I mean, toe-to-toe. I mean, did they?
Yeah, well, they asked them afterwards. I don't know if we even know who it was or if it's a combination story, but one of these guys, and they said, well, what? Look on a globe, look at the size of the U.S. and look at the size of Japan. How could you think you could attack us? And they said, you know, everything that they'd done up to that point, you said you wouldn't fight. And so we didn't think all of a sudden one day that you would decide to fight. And this happens often in war, where the one side just really miscalculates, gets really full of themselves. And, you know, again, to go back to Churchill, yet again, for all his wisdom, he said, remember when England was going to go fight the Boers in South Africa at the turn of the century, turn of the last century, he said, you know, there wouldn't be a war at all if the other fellow didn't think he had a chance.
Right.
So always be wary when somebody tells you a war is going to be easy, because there wouldn't be a war in the first place.
Right.
If you know, I mean, if I go fight Pee Wee Herman, you know, okay, I'm pretty confident. But, you know, he could have been studying karate all.
Well, he's got very, very fast hands, or at least one fast hand.
Yeah. Strong forearm.
Yeah.
You know, so you never know. You got to, you know, you can't ever prejudge anybody. And that's what I think the Japanese, unfortunately, by their racist outlook of the Imperial Japanese, like the Nazis, they just didn't think that these other people could band together and beat them.
If Adolf, I thought you said these allies couldn't fight.
Yeah.
It's amazing listening to these two when you realize that these guys in the field were using what was then called portable equipment.
Yeah, portable. That was great. Think about your iPhone, folks. Now, portable, in this case in 1941, was a unit that could instantly record sound to disks, and these are not floppy disks, these are not CDs, and play them back on the spot. And it weighed only 130 pounds.
Nice. Yeah, that's about 520 iPhones, more or less. Which
520 iPhones? It's just insane to even... I mean, think of probably every iPhone you've ever seen is maybe 100.
Right.
And that's 520. That's how 130 pounds. I mean, it's like carrying around a person. And also, people weren't necessarily as large as they are today. They were much shorter and, you know, lighter. And they hadn't been training for war.
No.
So this is a lot. And these guys just dragged this out there to, you know, there's those moments in history sometimes where people just have a brilliant insight of taking stock of that moment and recording it. And that was one of those moments that they just decided to do this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the striking things about these recordings is something we keep going back to, something that keeps striking us, is that these are just average people. They're just speaking from their hearts, speaking from their minds, naturally and passionately. This is way before every Yutz had a Twitter feed or a podcast. Or
hey, that's us!
At Angry History on Twitter and Facebook.com/AngryHistory. Yes, but we're not Yutzes. That's
no, right. No.
But there was just this amazing ability to speak as real people without having lived their life ever seeing TV or ever, you know, they had a radio. But, and you look at a great example of this is go to YouTube, watch any video of Dwight D. Eisenhower talking on camera. he's terrible on camera. I mean, the guy is like, he doesn't even know it's on him. He's, you know, it's not his fault. He just, when I came out of the Army finally, he couldn't even use the phone because they hadn't had direct dialing since he had a secretary while he was in the war the whole time.
That's right.
So he was like sitting there basically like the aliens on Sesame Street, you know, yelling at the phone. I picture him, you know, boing, 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 like picking it up and going, give me some hello.
Yes, hey. Hello. Right.
So it's complete, and these people, so you just know this is really what they're thinking. There's the nowadays, Owen and I have both gone out with crews and done Man on the Streets, usually at that TKTS there in Times Square.
Yeah.
Like, you go there, those people are used to how to act today on the camera. Everybody knows it. Everybody's been filmed since pretty much they were children if they're of a certain age. But these people, this is probably the first time their voice is ever recorded and the last. They have these few seconds. They're in history and then they're gone.
And these are the people, too, who would fight and die, you know, in the months and years ahead because of this attack.
Yeah. Here's a guy like our grandfathers, three of our grandfathers anyway, two of yours, one of mine, and your uncles. We all had relatives that fought in this war. They served. This gentleman came from another shore and became a naturalized American. So let's listen to his soundbite.
The one who addresses you now, he's a... Puerto Rican by birth, working in the room service of the Hotel St. Regis in 55th Street and 5th Avenue. I just want to say a few words in connection with the declaration of war. While there were still going conversations between our government and Japan toward a peace settlement between our two governments, and especially shortly after President Roosevelt has sent the last appeal to the Orient Empire, that is through Emperor Hirohito, the Japanese forces stop our country in the back with the most savage and criminal bombardment over our possessions overseas. Fortunately, our nation is united, and with the tremendous might of our forces and our allies, we will fight through all sacrifices to a final victory for the sake of all free loving peoples of the world. As a Spanish by blood and an American citizen by virtue of the Jones Act passed by Congress in the year 1917, I rejoice this historical experience that Costa Rica gave the radical gesture of patriotism in declaring war against the aggressor, being the first of our hemispheric solidarity. I agree very heartily on the declaration of war against Japan. We all stand shoulder to shoulder to defend our democratic principles for us and the entire world.
Now, I would like to put this guy in a room and have him sit down with our salesman that we heard from earlier. Just not just for the reasons that you're thinking, but think about where this man comes from. He comes from Puerto Rico.
Right.
He's grown up. I don't know. We don't know how old he is. We don't know anything about him. But certainly within the living memory of his parents, at least, his country was a territory of Spain. And then we had the Spanish-American War. Mm-hmm. They became a territory of the U.S., as did Manila, that the Japanese also attacked when they attacked Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And yet his attitude towards us is not at all like the attitude we were just talking about of the Ukrainians when the Nazis invade. And they say, oh, these new guys, they could be better. Or the Asian countries that thought, well, we don't want Europeans here, which you could understand in a place like China or a place like the Philippines. They'd rather maybe have somebody in their own neighborhood and be a protectorate. And yet they ended up really fighting to throw that off. Not that we didn't have many Puerto Rican nationals that felt that way,
right.
But I don't think you'd, this guy, just the tone of his voice and the way that he talks about America, it really shows, I think, how strongly that sense of belonging, and he says shoulder to shoulder, standing shoulder to shoulder together.
He is proud, and you can, and he's you can tell he's mad beneath the subtext, beneath the sort of controlled tone, and there's such dignity in this man's voice too. I love it.
Yeah, it's a really, really great soundbite. Here are a pair who on the surface couldn't sound much different, but are united by what really does come across as a simple matter of right versus wrong. First, let's hear from the cabbie.
I'm a taxi cab chauffeur. I'm a veteran of the last World War. When I heard of the sneaky way the Japs started their aggressive war, I was very much shocked. I believe the United States should try their utmost to beat them, gain a victory, and I'm willing to fight again to do my bit towards that end.
I freaking love his voice more than I love Taffy, and I'm a man who loves his Taffy.
Yeah, cut from the cloth of Professor Archie Bunker. And I think that's one thing to mention that I like that we're doing this way is, you know, he uses a word today that you wouldn't use about the Japanese, which I think is also really shows something we should be aspiring to as mm-hmm. a country. And I think the fact that Japan so quickly became an ally of ours, is still a close ally of ours, it just shows you we like to focus a lot on things that we do wrong, which is great because I think that's a good thing for a nation or an individual.
Yep.
But we really did some things right that now we could say, hey, you know, it'd be easy enough to sit around and say, well, screw them. We're going to hold it on them forever. And that's actually a lot of reason why, you know, you said before, Japan and China, they're fighting every few years. You know, Germany and its neighbors, fighting. Britain stomping all over the world. You know, it's like,
it's true.
It's like, you know, people are, you know, including on us. So, I mean, it's like, so this is just, that word really jumped out at me. And I think for a reason maybe that people wouldn't ordinarily think is you look at a cab driver today and you're not going to hear that. And it's just because we decided, hey, kind of leave the old world behind, which has always been the ideal.
Sure. That's America. Right?
Now, first we had that taxi cab driver. Here's his much younger counterpart. Let's hear how he talks about the Japanese.
Okay.
I'm a student of New York City. I am 18 years of age. That is, I was 18 last month. And seeing that the president, his opinions were in favor of war, it means I might be a potential soldier in the very near future. Personally, I'm a pacifist. But at times, circumstances overrule your personal opinions. I don't believe that the president had any other alternative but to declare war against Japan. And I realize that there's no further use for diplomacy. I believe that the entire diplomatic move by Japan was just a stall for time. And hence, as Mr. Wheeler has said, that the best thing to do now is to lick hell out of him.
It's funny not to, you know, lump all young people today into the same saucer, which you would stir, by the way. This doesn't sound like an 18-year-old. I mean, this sounds like certainly a young man, but he seems like he's got his act together, you know. And the fascinating thing to me is he's a pacifist. He does not want to fight, but he seems to realize that this is it and there's no choice. And I don't know, again, this is another anonymous speaker, but it sounds like he's ready to suit up.
Yeah, he's ready for the call to come. I mean, he's basically waiting, you know, to hear that he's going to have to go. And I think it's just the maturity of life back then. I think people, it's odd because we talk about kids growing up much faster today. This man's obviously not a kid. I mean, he's a young adult. He's still in his teens. But it's growing up in a different way. It's not, you know, this guy might have been much more innocent towards things about sex than your current 12-year-old is. And yet, yeah. The ways of the world and war and knowing what it's really going to take, he was much more mature, just judging by the sound of his voice and thinking this is really a cross-section. This is just a guy they grabbed. You know, not any pre-interviewing, not any, you know. I think if you just grabbed your average 19, 18-year-old like that, I think that's really something to aspire to. And the same would have gone for me when I was that age.
Absolutely, no doubt about it. It's interesting, though, when you contrast, you know, the cabbie or the taxicab chauffeur, as he called himself.
Yeah, it was classy.
Who was a veteran and of the First World War, and he was ready to suit up again. And and this young man at the other age of the other end of the age spectrum, and apparently of the ideological spectrum as far as war goes, both these guys were ready to sacrifice for their country because this was unequivocally wrong what had happened.
I think it was a response that the Japanese really didn't count on. I think if they had come at the U.S. in a different way, maybe.
Right.
I mean, today maybe we look at it and say, well, okay, it was a military installation that they wanted to attack. They wanted to sink our fleet. That was their strategy. But I don't think they counted on the morale aspect. I think that they thought it would be completely different. I think that because the U.S. kept backing up and just trying to stay out of the war, to a people that were so militaristic and had allies in the Germans that were so militaristic and spoiling for a fight, that it really looked like, well, they're just going to, you know, roll over and ignore it and say, oh, gosh, look at this. We got our nose bloodied and we want out of it.
Right.
And I think they didn't calculate that the attitude would be like, hey, that's not fair play.
Right.
There's a great old show. I don't know. It might be a Magnum P.I. It's one of those shows that Ernest Borgnine was on every show back in the 70s and 80s.
With Cannon?
Yeah. The late awesome Ernest Borgnine just passed
sure
away.
Was.
And there's just a fight going on in a bar, and I guess it's Magnum or whoever, tough guy at the moment, getting beat up, and one guy...
Mannix. Sorry.
He had a sheepdog.
Yeah.
And he's getting jumped by one guy. He's fighting one guy, and then his friend jumps him. And Ernest Borgnine just jumps right in, right there. Something you could see him doing in McHale's Navy. And he says, hey, I don't like those odds. That's not fair.
He's
like,
right.
And he fights. And, you know, he's this old guy. Even at that point, he just kicks the crap out of some younger guy, and you're cheering for him. And then Magnum thanks him, and he just simply says to him, I just didn't like the odds. He didn't like that somebody snuck in and sneak attacked him. And I think that was something that the Japanese didn't count on stirring inside Americans when they attacked Pearl Harbor. It was just, well, this is a military target. We're going to get it. We're going to push them out of the Pacific, and we'll get rid of them. But unfortunately, they really miscalculated. Fortunately for the Japanese and for the Americans who had to fight and die.
That's right. All right. This one, Dean, is especially for you, and give a listen.
I'm a housewife. I was born in Greece, but I'm an American citizen. I hate war, but I love my freedom and independence. As you know, the Greeks always fought for their freedom and independence, and I guess that's why I feel the same way about it.
I could smell the garlic from here and taste the geftedis. I mean, these are like Churchill yet again said in the war when the Greeks were fighting to the point where the German general in charge of the occupation of Crete said he would go to the window of his office just to watch the Cretan civilians, these people were, meet their execution, because they were just so stoic about it and they were so determined. And after some of these battles is when Churchill famously said, no longer will we say that Greeks fight like heroes. Now we'll say heroes fight like Greeks.
There you go.
Cannot explain what's happening now, but as for World War II, they were really heavily fighting.
Well, we could level that confusion in a lot of different directions now, you know, but interesting. I just thought it was cool to hear her. And again, these a lot of these I pulled from New York for obvious reasons, but I just loved the thought of this woman who, you know, I could picture her, and I can see, you know, not like, you know, your mom was born in England, but just, there's just a certain rich character to her voice, which the romantic in me just gets pulled back. I don't know.
Okay. Well, you could feel yourself in her kitchen. I mean, that's the thing. These people, all of them, you could see. I find when I listen to them, I picture them each at a different place.
Mm-hmm.
You hear the guy's a student. You listen to his voice, kind of a young guy. You're picturing him in the library. You're picturing the cabbie in a bar. You're picturing this lady here in the kitchen, you know, maybe with a kid hanging on her apron and a rolling pin in her hand. And, you know, it's like, this is just amazing that you found these right out of these people's lives, just reaching back into time and getting their reactions, and then they just disappear into the ether in the rest of their lives.
Well, that's it. It's like, you know, and all praise goes to Alan Lomax. You know, it's really amazing that we have this now. I mean, he thought this needed to be preserved for the ages, and by God, he did it, you know. All right, moving on a little bit now. Historian Stephen Ambrose once told National Geographic News, quote, soldiers were fighting the world's worst racist, Adolf Hitler, in the world's most segregated army, end quote.
Yeah, I wonder who said that first. Oh, what a heartbreaker Stephen Ambrose was.
Oh, gosh, that was awful. Oh,
yeah, yeah, we found out that he copied and made up so much stuff out of whole cloth. But if you look at some of those videos of him from the 70s, he's clearly pretty high, those crazy hippie sweaters. So I think he probably thinks he really did sit down and talk to Eisenhower, but it was like probably just a bald plant or something.
Yeah, right. Here's Lex Luthor in a comic book behind a magnifying glass.
Why do you keep calling the cat Ike? But all kidding aside here, there was the very serious reflection in this war that I don't think most people really think about. It certainly back when the History Channel actually had history, even they didn't really cover it. And that is that black soldiers and civilians were not on equal footing in society, and certainly not in equal footing on the battlefield. Black enlisted men knew damn well they wouldn't be fighting alongside their white counterparts. They would also go, even when they would go back on, behind enemy lines, say in France, they wouldn't be going to the officers' mess, and German POWs would be allowed to go in there and sit down and have a drink with white American soldiers. And these guys were fighting and dying, and they would suffer that. And I really have yet to really hear much bitterness from them, which is a whole nother level of heroism.
Yep. And the Marines wouldn't even take them until later in the war. It's just nuts, you know.
Yeah, and that was actually Ike's report to Truman that helped finally desegregate, ultimately, the armed forces. Because people did have their doubts. I mean, they were raised with these misconceptions, just like the Japanese or just like Americans had about other countries or any country had. And they had to really see them in action. And to their eternal credit, I mean, they went and proved themselves in war after war after war from the Revolutionary War onward, mm-hmm. until people finally said, well, what are you going to believe, your own eyes or your, you know, what the Archie Bunker cab driver's been telling you?
Right.
And same thing for the Army Air Corps. I mean, the 99th Pursuit Squadron, known to history and the world as the legendary Tuskegee Airmen, that was formed in 1941, but those pilots wouldn't fly with white pilots until 1944, right?
And once they did, they you know, apparently had to stand out work. You know, according to the Tuskegee Airmen National Museum, they were the only U.S. unit to sink a German destroyer using 50 caliber machine guns. That's insane. Can you imagine that?
I hope the Germans had a little glimpse of who was in the planes, too, because that would have been pretty cool.
Exactly. It just always makes me think of of Jesse Owens at the 36 Olympics in Berlin, you know, just stuffing it down Adolf's throat.
Yeah.
You know? It's like...
Well, and there was a... We could probably do a whole, like, podcast on that, but there was a story recently about that, recently being the last couple of years, and you know, some guy came out and said, no, Hitler really liked him. And it was really good. They hung out and after the games, and he said, I don't know. I need to see a little bit more proof because I don't think Hitler was that kind of guy, you know?
Right.
I mean, anybody, if an athlete comes and whips all your athletes, much less Hitler, much less a guy who happens to be black, I don't think that he was, you know, come back to my place for some schnitzel and coffee.
Right. Exactly.
I have to apologize to all of our German listeners for constantly doing the German voice. I know it's horrible. I am... making fun of myself, not you.
Blame it on Mel Blanc.
Yeah, right. But let's back up. Back to December 8th, 1941, when the battleship Arizona is still smoldering there in Pearl Harbor. Two of Lomax's collectors, Lewis Jones and Charles Johnson, interviewed Colorado native Fady France. She was an African-American woman working as a secretary at a YWCA in Nashville, Tennessee. So let's give a listen to her and her perspective.
Japan's aggression was an expected act. We must take into consideration the Japanese ruthless aggression toward China throughout the past 4 years and concede the fact that Japan is an aggressive nation. However, this particular act was not entirely of Japanese making. This war situation had to reach a head soon. The United States was bound to enter this war. Just what the fuse was to be was the only uncertain factor. Rather than Japan's aggression, I would say Japan's obedience to instigated commands by the Axis powers. As so many others who were not active participants or witnesses of the last world war, the actual horror or seriousness of combat has not dawned on me as yet, just a mild excitement that naturally comes with mass action, the usual response of an individual to group psychology. Because of this follows my reaction to Japan. Being just another of the uninformed masses, I have a feeling of resentment toward Japan for her treacherous, sly attack on the United States. Words and thoughts put into my mouth by radio news commentators and writers of newspaper articles. Yet an actual hatred for Japan herself does not exist within me. She is the tool of stronger powers. My resentment is definitely directed toward them. I impatiently await the finish of Japan so that the Axis powers, the motivating factors for this recent aggression, can be stopped in their murderous attempts to thwart the cause of democracy and liberty, their greedy attempts to rule the world and resources of all countries. My faith and belief in the superiority of the United States is childlike in its entirety, even though the treatment of minority groups has been and is still unfair. My loyalty to my country is unlimited and unbounded.
Wow, I mean, that's what a statement.
I know. Do you not just want to stand up and cheer for this lady?
I mean,
you look in the mirror tomorrow and shave. You say, how can I be more like this woman?
Yeah,
literally.
I mean, just that last sentence, you know. Even though the treatment of minority groups has been and is still unfair, my loyalty to my country is unlimited and unbounded. And it's just, I don't know, just something about everything that she said. She nails something 72 years ago. She nailed everything that's wrong with media today.
Yeah. And think about it also, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, she's in Tennessee. Now, this is a lady who wants to stop for lunch and can't go to the lunch counter.
Exactly.
She's a lady who's thirsty for a drink of water and she can't use the water fountain that's
there. Can't do it.
You know, and yet she says this. And we don't, whoever we are, I mean, today we can look at the country and say, oh, there are these problems, there are things that we don't like, but can we rise above and have this level of forgiveness as we hope we would be forgiven? I mean, we all do bad things to people. And we all have bad things done to us. And yet, do we really have this level of forgiveness in us to go and help somebody, maybe a neighbor who's a jerk to us all the time, and then you see his house on fire, you're going to run in, you're going to run away and pretend you didn't see it.
Right.
It's just this level of really touching you. Again, these are great that you found.
No, I'm so glad I did, too. And just listening to her, and she's either a woman out of time or she's timeless, you know, one or the other. I'm not quite sure which. You know, you think about this war, too, and what it did do. It began to slowly spark what would be the modern civil rights movement. I mean, you know, you had black soldiers being able to fight toward the end of the war alongside whites. You know, everyone's blood is red. But then desegregation happened.
Not Spock's.
That's true. Not Spock's. But you know what?
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. Go ahead.
That's all right. He probably wouldn't. Would Spock fight? It's interesting.
But, I'm sorry. I should
No. But it did begin to, you know, it was sort of the modern America that emerged on the other side of this war, at least the beginnings of it. You know, and obviously, you know, you look at the headlines today. Gosh, we still have far to go with how we treat each other and how we even communicate with one another. But I was just so struck by when she says, you know, being just another of the uninformed masses. I have a feeling of resentment toward Japan, but you know, words and thoughts are put into my mouth by radio news commentators and writers of newspaper articles. I mean, she's saying, pay attention. Don't take everything at face value, which is what we should always do now. And especially, you know, the noise machine wasn't nearly turned up as loud then as it is now. And it's hard to sometimes stop and get a bead. You know, we always talk about, you know, get multiple sources or, you know, cull your news from an aggregation of different sources to try to maybe average out something which is more or less true. But I don't know. I was just struck by Miss France. And
More escapable. You know, you could escape it then if you wanted to escape news. I mean, the newspapers came out a few times a day. There were a lot more of them. But you'd go to the movie, then you'd see the images. Okay, you'd see the newsreel. And
right.
Those were propaganda, and there was no reason we weren't going to expect propaganda in any
sure.
way that you're going to fight. But you could get away from it. You didn't have your phone. You'd talk to people
mm-hmm.
in a place like McSorley's in World War II. Very, very active. And that's where you got your news. Actually talking to people face-to-face. And if you were going to talk to somebody who was a pacifist or talk to somebody who was like that cabbie chauffeur, you were going to actually speak to them in their face and be face-to-face, and you just won't say things that you'll say about or to somebody on behind the safety of an anchor desk or behind the safety of a blog. Or
yep.
I was listening to Brian Williams the other day, and he said the internet comment is the cheapest currency that there is.
It sure is.
What a great line. He was on with Alec Baldwin on his great show that he has there, and I thought it was too bad because he says, you know, they bother him, the comments that some people will make, but it's really cheap stuff, and you didn't have that. Now it's almost a compulsion, and I think people will do that and as a substitute for actually going out and doing something positive.
That is the absolute truth. I think, you know, I've said it before as we were, you know, sculling beers and McSorley's, but I think, you know, online social media is playing a large part in gutting us as a nation. I mean, it's stripping us of ambition. You know, it's instead of doing something active and proactive, you know, we're keeping up with likes and we're, you know, looking at, you know, page hits and page views. And I don't know, it's just, you know, nothing has time to digest. Could you imagine fighting the Second World War with the level of social media where it is now? It would be insane. We wouldn't have the sack for it.
Yeah. No, you know? I mean, we wouldn't have a media either that was willing to pitch in and be part of that war effort, and you have to cover things up, or it's literally national suicide. If they'd been able to run with those photos off of the beaches, you know,
yep.
You can compare storming the beaches at Normandy to even going into Somalia and having the media right there waiting for the soldiers to go
That's
on
right.
the beach. I mean, that would have just been impossible. You yep. couldn't have had it. And you know what? We've had these jobs, we've done them, and we know how it is and how gross you feel looking at some of that stuff that you've written or edited. And you say, you know, you're staging a car wreck every single day to get people to watch.
It's
you're
true.
Trying to make it sound as bad as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing, and it's counterproductive because you build up these enemies like the Japanese and then Hitler, and then you try to back away, and then they start to read their own press and think that they're unbeatable,
yeah.
and that they're supermen.
Yep, yep. Well, listen, I wanted to save this one for last because of, well, let's just hear what Redondo Beach, California native Mrs. Lena Jameson had to say. Interviewed on December 9th, 1941, while visiting her children in Dallas. Here is Lena Jameson.
My first thought was, what a great pity that the world at large, that another nation should be added to those aggressors who strove to limit our freedom. I find myself at the age of 80, an old woman, hanging on to the tail of the world, trying to keep up. I do not want the driver's seat, but of the eternal verities, there are certain things that I wish to express. One thing that I am very sure of is that hatred is death. But love is life.
Now, think about that 80-year-old woman in 1941. Now, she's born in, what?
1860, maybe?
So she goes from the attack on Fort Sumter that starts the Civil War
yeah.
all the way to Pearl Harbor that starts World War II. And that's her lifetime. That's how much war she's grown up after and between. She's lived through the panics of the late 1800s. She's lived through the Great Depression. She's lived through countless presidents. She's lived through three presidential assassinations.
Oh, goodness.
And another one that died in office. I mean, this is what she's seen.
Well,
in her
Lincoln,
lifetime.
Garfield, McKinley, right?
Ay, yeah.
Ay, yeah.
Ay, and then Harding. Harding died.
Harding died.
Possibly wife killed him.
That's
very
right.
Weird, very weirdly.
And her big takeaway is, having been through all that, one truth that she seems to know still is that hatred is death, and love is life. It reminds me of something that a friend of ours, a woman named Margot Stevenson, who died a couple of years ago, and she lived to be 98 or so. She was wonderful. She was an actress, married to a great character actor named Val Avery, who, as a matter of fact, season 2, episode 1 of Law & Order, he plays the guy's father, who was on the grand jury, Dean, who in the Greevy grand jury.
Oh,
anyway,
right.
But he's been in Gallipoli. You've seen him in a million things. Anyway, this was about 5 days after the attacks of September 11th. And our friend Maria was in a play on Broadway and was going into previews. And we were all like, okay, cool. Let's try to do something that is not, you know, has nothing to do with the insanity that was going on. And so we went up to see Maria's Hedda Gabler up on Broadway. And afterwards, we were at one of these great Theater Row restaurants. And Margot was 88 at this point, and she was there. And we were sitting there in the corner talking, having a drink. And she was asking me how I was doing, and I was like, huh? And her sort of big point was, as she was at 88, she just didn't want to leave the world in this state. You know, that was her big thing. She had seen so much. She you know, had been through, you know, certainly the Second World War and all the wars up till the attack. And her big thing was just, you know, she didn't want to leave her world and her city this way. And it just reminded me of what, you know, Mrs. Jameson had to say. And it always stuck with me. You know, Margot fortunately had a bunch of good years left in her after the attacks. Whether or not it gave her any comfort to see the state of the world when she did die, I don't know. But there you go.
When they bombed Pearl Harbor that night, you know, Tojo, he jumped up out of the bed, man. Dial the operator. Operators, give me 1109. Say, I want to speak to Adolf Hitler, who is a personal friend of mine. Saying, look, operator, say, I want you to get these numbers straight. to tell $8 ain't no use of rushing because we're already too much up with the lady. By that time, the phone rang, you know, and $8 jumped up out of his bed. No hat on his head, no shoes on his feet, and his heart beating like steel. Because he know Tojo was his driving wheel. Hello, Tojo. He said, hello, $8. I'm just calling. I know you're the king of Japan. He said, yeah, but I'm calling you to tell you that I'm a worried man. He said, I just told my wife before I left, if I get to your ass, I'd kick your ass myself. Saying, something you told me came out right. I thought you said them allies couldn't fight.
In the days after these recordings were made, thousands enlisted from coast to coast, from all different backgrounds, to take the fight to the Axis powers, joining those already registered for the draft. These oral histories occupy unique space in the American story. They represent a brief null time where the United States and her people stood at the edge of her great maturity.
We were punched, slapped in the mouth, and we did not like the taste. And while that quote attributed to Pearl Harbor architect Isoroku Yamamoto may be apocryphal, a sleeping giant was indeed awakened that day. And we dominated inside and outside the combat arena going forward.
All that you've heard today were recorded on December 8th, 9th, and 10th of 1941. It will be 2 months before FDR signed his infamous Executive Order 9066. That was the law that sent thousands of Japanese Americans and Americans that had really no connection to Japan at all other than through their ancestors. It sent them to camps and locked them up, including the great George Takei of Star Trek fame.
Takei. The Japanese Takei means expensive.
I just like hearing you say that.
I know you do.
And he's actually got a play coming out called Allegiance about this very topic.
No, we'd love him. We're going to try to get him on someday. We love him. So.
Yeah, so that was a real, real dark moment for FDR, and I personally don't think that he gets enough crap in history for doing it. But unfortunately, this particular collection does not contain any interviews with Japanese Americans. We heard a lot of Americans from different backgrounds, but it would have been great if we could have heard from somebody like, say, the late Senator Daniel Inouye, who lost an arm fighting against the Axis, or some other Japanese Americans. Not that they would have had anything to prove, but just they were Americans too, and the fact that that was really something that came from the president on down by signing this, and it would have been nice to have been able to hold one of them up. Maybe one of the things that we did do right after 9/11, talking about it, was, you know, we didn't immediately go and start shoving a lot of people in camps. And let's face it, there would have been a lot of people who would have been all for it, saying, well, all right, it's all the Saudis. Let's start rounding them up. You know, and that was, you know, FDR gets a lot of credit for a lot of good things, and I think people like somebody to be either all good or all bad, but this was really a bad call on his part. And, you know, he wasn't the most racially tolerant guy, and that kind of opened the door to be able to do that.
Absolutely. It would have been so nice, he said, just to hear on December 8th, 9th, or 10th, you know, before the order and before the hysteria, just to hear what a Japanese-American person felt about this. So we're going to keep digging. Maybe these things are out there someplace, and we hope to find them. But all of these recordings, as well as many more like them from places like, you know, Washington, D.C., Wisconsin, Colorado, North Carolina, Vermont, all places that would soon join every other town and city with American blood in offering up its treasure to fight our enemy. All these can be found online through the Library of Congress. Just search for After the Day of Infamy.
We'll also throw up some links to Alan Lomax's amazing legacy, thousands of songs and interviews he recorded over six full decades of passionate work to preserve the folklore, both of domestic and international. It's really amazing stuff, and we're so glad to be able to share it with you. We hope you enjoyed listening to as much as I do, and Owen did, and you'll reflect on it a little bit.
I hope so. Well, listen, this was a fun one, and folks out there, thanks as always for joining us. My name's Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis, and the man you're listening to in the background is Who Owen from singing the great Tojo Told.
That is Holly Springs, Mississippi's own R.L. Burnside. May he rest in peace.
May he rest in peace. God bless his smutty little soul, Krusty the Clown once said.
Exactly. All right, guys. We'll see you soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You fool us well off down yon in Bougainville. For 15,000 of our best men just fucked around and got killed. See, that's what I told her last night before I left.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.